do something you're passionate about, you're going to spend an awful lot of time. It'll be a lot of ups and a lot of downs. Know that going in, and be committed, be prepared, do something that you're passionate about. Do it with people you like and that you share the same values with. Over the long run, what is your basic approach to life? What are your values? And who do you want to be around? You're going to be with those people a lot. Like everything else, it comes down to being with great people. Make sure, and then I would say, treat your life like an investment.
That's how success happens. From Entrepreneur Magazine, my name is Robert Tuckman. I self-funded, built up, and eventually sold two businesses to major players in the sports and entertainment industry. And I am fascinated by other entrepreneurial minds and what drives high-achieving people. So on this podcast, we're going to learn what they've learned and what it takes to really succeed. Today, Josh Harris is a co-owner of the NBA's Philadelphia 76ers, as well as the NHL's New Jersey Devils. Initially, Josh found mega success as one of the founders of Apollo Global Management in 1990. And today, Apollo is one of the largest alternative investment management companies in the world. While at Apollo, Josh went on to also co-found Harris Blitzer Sports and Entertainment, a company created to accelerate community growth and explore strategic investment opportunities in sports, entertainment, and media. I had a chance to sit down with Josh earlier this month as his Sixers were starting out on their playoff campaign. Our conversation is coming up after the break. Now, let me ask you a question. Are you frustrated with how long it takes to get stuff done in your business, or with how chaotic or confusing things seem to get? Well, then let me tell you about a much better way of getting work done. And let me tell you about an amazing tool that will help you overcome the frustrating log jams in your business. Sweet Process is a simple but powerful tool that lets you create clear step-by-step instructions for every task in your business, from onboarding new customers to training employees to responding to customer requests, so everything gets done more easily and more reliably. Plus, you'll have a central place where everyone who works with you, your employees, contractors, and even virtual assistants can access your procedures anytime from any device. The best way to understand how Sweet Process streamlines your work is to start using it. The company offers a 14-day free trial, but as a loyal listener of the How Success Happens podcast, you can try it for 28 days free of charge. You don't even have to enter a credit card to get started. Just navigate to sweetprocess.com/HSH to start your free 28-day trial today. And now, on with the show. We're back. I began my conversation by asking Josh about his wrestling career. Growing up, he was an exceptional wrestler. And knowing the dedication needed in that sport, I was curious how his experience with the sport helped shape his professional career.
I got into wrestling by accident. I was 10 years old and I won a camp tournament and realized that, okay, I may be pretty good at this. But I joined the Bethesda Boys Club outside of Washington, D.C. and realized that I was up against kids that had been wrestling since they were 4 or 5, and quickly realized that unless you ran, unless you lifted, unless you prepared, you got physically dominated on the mat. And there's nothing like that experience to teach you about working hard in life and being prepared and disciplined. So I started off, and once I started doing all those things, that all of a sudden I started winning. And so that was a huge life lesson to me and ultimately helped me prepare for life. And I started applying that same rigor to my academics, which weren't very good at the time. And as I started applying that rigor in high school, my academics improved, and then ultimately everything I do now has been enlightened by this notion that, like, you know, discipline and preparation and focus and hard work, allows you to achieve success and do better.
Yeah, I would have to say, I mean, just knowing people who've wrestled, seeing it, even going back to high school, it takes a lot of effort, determination, really drive. And where does that drive come from, do you think, personally in yourself? Because I know a lot of people who would not put in that time or effort.
Yeah, I'm just driven to have a huge impact in whatever I'm doing. And I'm very competitive, for good or for bad. I mean, maybe one of the reasons that I got involved with professional sports is we've all been high school and college athletes, but being around the best players in the world and watching what they do and what they have to go through to be successful at their craft. But I would say that it's something that has comes inside of me and really has been there since very young and continues even today.
Yeah. And you talked about it. You went off to Penn after high school. Now, did you continue to wrestle in college as well?
I did. I wrestled for a portion of Penn in 1982 and 1983. And quickly, but I was also trying to achieve and do well in school. And I'll never forget, we were up against some of the best wrestlers in the world. We wrestled in the EIWA, and I wrestled. I remember one day I had to wrestle against Bobby Weaver, who ultimately won an Olympic gold medal. And so I was I ended up doing it for part of the time, but I was faced with this choice of, okay, if I wanted to, I had reoriented my life a little bit around business and fell in love with that and was studying at Wharton, which is part of Penn. But it was a really enjoyable experience at Penn. And I got to compete at a very high level in the NCAAs. And it was something that will stay with me for a long time. I'm actually involved today with the Penn wrestling team in terms of helping and supporting them. And I watch what these individuals go through to get prepared. It's incredible.
Yeah, I just remember, I think back to high school and growing up, and they would work out back in the 80s too. And you just see the steam and like the windows fogged. And like, I've never seen, I don't know if there's other sports where the athletes are training so hard, putting in the effort, the dedication. And I always admired that. But for you then at Wharton, was that the first time you really started to find an interest in investing while you were there?
Yeah, so my dad was an orthodontist, so I never heard of Wharton. He'd gone to Penn. He sang the Red and the Blue songs. And
yeah.
I grew up, and so it was clearly in my DNA that if I was lucky enough to be accepted and for them to allow me to go, that was always going to be my first choice. And so when I got accepted, I was just a regular university student, but then I took an economics class and I just loved it. And back in those days, you could literally just sign, if you had the right academic average, you could just sign something that allowed you to transfer to Wharton. So I transferred to Wharton. My parents used to joke that they found out about it by getting a letter from the school. And so I never even told them. And so ultimately that's how I got into Wharton. And then I just was studying, and you know, my father was like, you need to be an accountant, because that's kind of a solid and safe profession and you'll earn a living. And I was very allured and excited about finance and Wall Street and helping companies. That was always, back in those days, that was a really exciting prospect for someone like me. And I'll never forget, I just ignored him, and I got my first job junior year summer, and I went with him to buy a suit. I didn't own a suit. So I had one suit and one blazer and khaki pants. And I literally went down to Wall Street and, you know, worked on Wall Street at 13 Wall Street, Brown Brothers Hair. Man, I never forget how excited I was. So that was the transition. I got into it by accident, but I loved it and I was excited about it. And I think that's really important if you're going to do something, is like having that excitement and allure to it.
Yeah. What was it initially, do you think, or what was it that really, that energy that you felt that was alluring to you about Wall Street?
Well, I think at that time, if you were studying business and finance, that was where all the best people were going, right? And it felt to me that it was an apprenticeship business. It felt to me like if I was going to learn, I wanted to learn the most I could. And I was really a sponge for knowledge. I wanted to learn everything I could. And ultimately, I felt I could learn from the best people. And so that was where I was oriented. Where could I go where the best people were going, where I could learn the most? And my perception was that that was Wall Street. And my other perception was that on Wall Street, that they would give younger people a lot of responsibility at an early age, which is actually the case. And so those were the allures for me.
Yeah. Were you putting in a lot of long hours early on and did they have you working around the clock?
Yeah. So I did what was called a financial analyst program. And so the where all the best students go if they want to work in finance is they go for a 2-year boot camp. where you work 80 or 100 hours a week every week, and you're thrown into a bullpen. You sit with a lot of other people, and you're given, you're modeling out spreadsheets and analysis and working on prospectuses and other things to allow for companies to go public and to raise financing. And the older people teach you, they mentor you, but what you need to do for them is work really hard and do whatever they want you to do. And so in terms of staying late and doing the financial models. And so that's what I did. And it was super exciting. It was super exhausting, but I was really motivated by it. And, you know, I'll never forget being up one time. We had a presentation to a company. We were trying to convince them to invest in another company. And it was 5 a.m. I couldn't concentrate. And the meeting was at 8. And I literally went to the gym and worked out for an hour. And that's how I got my head back together and ultimately completed the work. So that was what you went through. But you were with a lot of other great young people. You were working for super smart people. And so that sacrifice was worth it to me.
Yeah. Was it a really important part when you look back on your career, those couple of years, in terms of how it shaped you as an investor and just in business?
It was. So I went to Drexel, Burnham, Lambert. And at that point, a storied firm. And at that point, Drexel was dominating. They had started and pioneered the high yield market, right? Which was for companies that weren't established companies, they were growing companies. And it was a unique innovation. And they were also financing all of the leverage. But at that point, leverage buyouts were just beginning. No one had even heard of them. And so Drexel was financing all those buyouts. So all the smartest people, I could have gone anywhere at that time, were going to Drexel. And so it was the same thing where I oriented towards Drexel. And what Drexel, the great things about Drexel was that they were really smart people, but also very flat organization. It was smaller. It was a bit of an entrepreneurial situation. Still pretty big relative to a real startup, but relative to other Wall Street firms like Goldman Sachs or Morgan Stanley, much more of a newcomer. And all of those attributes were things that really drew me in to make that choice. And Drexel believed in flexibility across the balance sheet, you know, investing in debt, investing in equity, the ability to pivot and reorient around risk return, whatever the best risk return was at that time. At that time, they were focused on that for their clients. So that all that stuff was like integrated into my own credit skills, credit analysis, deep credit analysis. It got integrated into my DNA at an early age. And yeah, it did help me get ready for the next step in my career, which obviously was Apollo.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk about Apollo, but I know you had a quick stop at Blackstone, and you have to tell us the story, because I'm curious. It only lasted a few weeks before you left to start Apollo. And can you give us some background on that?
Yeah. So after the, I was working, you know, 900 hours a week, I said, look, I'm going to either stay, or I applied to one business school because I had gone to Wharton. And there was one that was complimentary. It was Harvard Business School. They used the case study method. And I said, look, if I could get into Harvard Business School, it was sort of the same thing. I'm going to be with incredibly smart people, and it's going to be a great life experience and a great learning experience. And so when I was lucky enough and fortunate enough to be accepted, I went, right? And met a whole bunch of people that have become super successful and great relationships for me now. One of my classmates runs GE today, as an example. But, you know, many times you walk in a room and it's your classmate that you were hanging out with when you were 25 years old. So I went to Harvard. And when I came out of Harvard, it was the great financial crisis, one of the great economic and financial crises that we've had. It was 1990, and it started with a savings and loan crisis, and the markets were decimated. Things were down. Companies couldn't get financing. The markets were shut. I had accepted a job at Blackstone, which was, becoming, it was 5 years old at that point, but it was really somewhat of an entrepreneurial opportunity, but it was a little more established. But then I got a call from two people I knew, Leon Black and Mark Rowan, and they said, look, why don't you join us? And at that point, even though I was in a good situation, I felt that there was a real opportunity to innovate and to do it with people that I knew and go into a business, private equity, that I felt was going to be successful. And so I took a risk. I left a very established, you know, at that point, a firm that looked like it was going to do quite well. I'll never forget, I went into Steve Schwartzman's office and I, with great trepidation, I resigned. And they had given me, I had a lot of student loans at that time, and they had given me a signing bonus of $15,000, which was like, to me, an enormous amount of money at that time. And I had literally used it to pay down the a couple loans that I had taken to go to business school. And then I said, I'm like to resign, but I don't, like, I need to pay you back and I don't have the money. And Steve said, just keep it. He was very gracious. But I joined Apollo, and obviously it's been a fantastic run. But, you know, I looked at it very analytically and it felt like the right opportunity for me at the right time.
Was, I know you said you went into his office with trepidation, but for you internally at the time, were you going back and forth with that decision? Was it something that you just knew and went with, or was there a possibility you may have some part of you really wanted to stay there?
Yeah, no, look, so I resisted. So Apollo was raising capital and Mark called me and said, this is great. You should come over. We're having a great time. It's small. Apollo was a pioneer in the strategy of buying good companies with bad balance sheets. So in a traditional leverage buyout, it's like buying a house. You put up your equity and then you borrow from a bank. You get a mortgage and then you buy a company, put it in a more distressed for control, it's called now, buyout. You go through a deleveraging process instead of a leveraging process. The company has too much debt and you take down the debt and right-size the capital structure and swap debt that you buy in the marketplace for equity. And that sounds, now a huge market, but back then no one was doing it. And so it was an innovation, and we had known, Drexel had financed a lot of those companies because it had been one of the dominant players in the high yield market. And so he kept trying to convince me to come over. I was resistant because Blackstone was more established and I was at the beginning of my career and was concerned about taking a risk with a company that was just starting up. But when I thought about it analytically, the chance to build something with people that I knew, where I thought we had a competitive advantage, I looked at my life almost like an investment decision. And this is what I would recommend to everyone to do. And I said, okay, how do I make, what's the right decision? More risk, but a lot of upside. And obviously now, you know, Apollo is the second largest alternatives player in the world. It's right there behind Blackstone, which is the largest. So and I was lucky enough to work at two of the great firms. There are a few others, but so that was how I made the decision. But for sure, if you're making a decision, an entrepreneurial decision, like all of us hear about all the success stories, but what you don't hear about is a lot of the stories that didn't work out. And for every success story, there's probably 100 stories that didn't work out. But for me, I felt that I had my Wharton education. I had my Harvard education. I had my Drexel training. I felt that I could get a job, you know, if it didn't work out. So I looked at the risk return and I treated my life like an investment decision. I made the decision and I haven't looked back since. And I've had one job, if you ignore the 2 weeks or 1 month at Blackstone. So since business school.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. And it's been an incredible ride. And I know just from what you've done, first off with Apollo, has been incredible.
More from our guest, but first, a word from our sponsors.
As a business owner, you know what it's like to run a business from your inbox. I'll be honest, I completely run my company, Amaze Media Labs, off of my inbox. I imagine just like you, between the sales recruiting and fundraising emails, to name just a few, things get messy. Streak is this great CRM that is designed to help you stay on top of each part of your process and your inbox. And get this, without ever leaving Gmail. I love the fact that Streak allows you to set up pipelines right inside your inbox to start tracking your contacts and emails through each process. It also offers tools for email tracking and mail merges that can save you tons of time and scale up your efficiency. And nothing is more important to me in that Streak lets you collaborate by sharing emails and pipelines with team members from the office or remote. It's also amazing in that it allows you to access your pipelines on desktop or the mobile app, offering an opportunity to share information in meetings, at job sites, or however you work on the go. So sign up for Streak today at streak.com/HSH and get 20% off your first year of their pro plan, their most popular option. That's streak.com/HSH for 20% off their pro plan. streak.com/HSH.
And our next sponsor.
This always happens to me these days. I look up from my laptop and it's already 3 p.m. Where has the day gone? I'm starving, only I can't leave because I have a Zoom coming up in the next 15 minutes. Starving, I then remember that I have DoorDash to turn to. Pull out my phone, order my favorite sandwich, and have it delivered right to my door. Satisfied and re-energized, I'm fueled up for my next Zoom meeting. In today's work environment, employee happiness is vital. This is why DoorDash for Work has a new kind of benefit for companies and their employees. Food benefits can help employee culture, performance, and productivity. With a Dash Pass for Work subscription, employees get free delivery and reduced fees on eligible orders from restaurants, grocery, and convenience stores, giving them time back in their day. Get DoorDash for Work and make work delicious. Go to work.doordash.com/success to learn more. That's work.doordash.com/success. Terms and conditions apply.
And we're back.
Were there any times early on where you maybe thought maybe I didn't make the right decision, or were there challenges too that you faced early on that you had to get over to make Apollo successful?
Sure. When you're starting up a firm, I mean, literally you're turning out the lights and sweeping the floor, and we're all stuffed in, you know, a small office space. And I'll never forget, actually, our first investment was a very large, very significant investment in a company called HBJ, Harcourt Brace Jovanovich, a publisher. And we missed, you know, no one had ever done this before, but we were buying these senior subordinated notes, and we were buying that tranche. And we thought that was the tranche that will, is what we call the fulcrum security, the security that will convert into the equity of the company in a restructuring, which we were hoping to lead. And we read the indentures, and we missed this little passage in the indenture, which allowed them to put debt on top of senior to our tranche, right? And subordinate us and use that cash for something else. So we, I'll never forget, all of us were reeling, trying to figure out, it was our first investment, it was a big chunk of our first fund, and trying to figure out, the debt traded down 10 points, and Leon walked in the room and screamed at all of us and walked out and said, we don't know what we're doing. And so for sure, you know, nothing is a straight line. This was not a straight up success. We went through many ups, many downs, but like ultimately the trajectory was amazing. And, you know, we went from a $400 million fund to an $800 million fund to $2 billion to $5 billion. And then we were off to the races. And so it was a really exciting time, but there were a lot of stressful points.
Yeah. And in building any business, as our listeners know, as entrepreneurs, it is always great to hear from someone like yourself, who's been uber successful in so many ways, that not everything is just that straight line up. But I know you guys did have a massive deal, from what I recall, potentially one of the biggest deals ever. I'm not sure. Can you talk about that deal and what that felt like at the time?
Sure. So in we were buying, you know, many, many companies that today are brand names: MCI, RJR, Nabisco, Converse Shoes, Lane & Broyhill Furniture, Samsonite Luggage, Colgan Water Systems, through this process of buying debt and then creating a liquidity for the companies by deleveraging and getting rid of that debt and putting in equity and getting rid of leverage. And so in the middle of all this, an insurance company called Executive Life, which had 300 different positions, needed to sell its portfolio to return capital to policyholders. It had gotten into a little bit of trouble. And so they did we did a very large deal where we bought their whole portfolio and literally went through and ultimately bifurcated the portfolio into companies we wanted to own and companies we didn't want to own, and then sold off different bond positions into the market, but ended up creating a lot of equity positions in different companies. And there were a couple of people that wanted to do that. That was in the early 90s. And ultimately, that kind of put us on the map. All of a sudden, we had this huge portfolio of companies. But at that point in 1995, we raised an institutional fund, and now we're on Fund 9. It's a $25 billion fund. And we also raised side-by-side credit, debt vehicles, and real estate investing vehicles. And now we're a very broad firm, and we manage about, just to give you a sense, $460 billion of assets. So from that humble beginning, which started as a $400 million fund, where we almost lost 20% of it in the first investment, we're now managing $450 billion of assets for clients, and so helping them with their retirements. And so the firm has grown. But along the way, there have been a lot of big deals. That was certainly one of them.
No, it's incredible deals. And it, just when you talk about that growth and those numbers, it's astounding. And I know, I think 2011, then you got involved and you purchased the Sixers. How did the whole transition go, and for you, and what was it about sports and wanting to get involved in the sports business?
Yeah, so first of all, I'd always loved sports, and I had got deep roots in Philly. And in 1982, when I was a freshman at Penn, that was the last time that the Sixers had won the NBA championship. And so, you know, it was indelibly in my brain, Dr. J and Moses Malone and Maurice Cheeks and Andrew Toney. And, you know, what I noticed, I was there when they won, and I noticed how excited the city was, and people came out in the streets. And I noticed how it brought, city was very, as it is today, racially charged and divided, but sports brought everyone into the streets together. Everyone was cheering for the Sixers. And so I'd been a fan since then. And I had heard that maybe the owner of the Sixers, Comcast, might be willing to sell the club. And I used my day job skills I called them literally, and they engaged in conversation with me. And 18 months later, we did what was called a corporate carve out, where, you know, the Sixers were part of the Arena and the Flyers, and they wanted to keep the Arena and the Flyers, but they were willing to part with the Sixers. And so we created lots of agreements, and how do you do scheduling, and what parts of the Arena do they run, what parts of the Arena do we run, all of these things that you go through. And we ring fence the Sixers and carve the Sixers out of Comcast Spectacor. And lo and behold, in the middle of a lockout, where the players and the owners, I'll never forget my first NBA meeting, there was a huge argument about whether to allow the season to move forward. It ended up being a shortened season. And the owners did vote to let it move forward and settle with the players become partners, 50-50 partners. But that's how we got started in sports. And it's been an incredible journey from there. We've built in sports.
Yeah. And not only with the Sixers, I'd love for you to talk about, I guess, first off, you have a partner in this, I believe, David Blitzer. And how do you guys initially get together to do this?
Yeah, so David and I had known each other for many years. In fact, David works at Blackstone. And when he's 4 or 5 years younger than me. And so when he went to Wharton, and when he was coming out of school, I tried to convince him to work at Apollo. And then I moved to London to run our global business for a couple of years in the 2008, 2009. And he was running Blackstone's office there in Europe. And I tried to convince him again to work with me. And so it took us buying a sports team together. I knew he was a huge fan. I had, my grandfather was a U.S. postal worker from Philly. My mom was first in our family to go to school at Temple. My dad went to Penn. He had gone to Penn. He had roots in the area. And so we decided to look at it together, and it's been a great 10-year partnership since then, along with a number of other people. But, you know, he's the main one, Michael Rubin here, runs Fanatics. So, that's how we got started. And we started off with the Sixers. And then in 2013, we bought the New Jersey Devils. And then in 2015, we bought a Premier League team called Crystal Palace in South London. And it's been, you know, sports is super fun, super exciting. You take on responsibility for a city. They're public assets. The City Cares. You know, I'll never forget the most successful deal I ever did was Lyondell. It's a $50 billion chemical company. And no one, like the amount of press that Lyondell gets, even though it impacts, you know, it's got thousands of employees and sells chemicals all over the world, is 1/1,000th of what the Sixers get. No one cares about the price of polypropylene, but they care an awful lot about every single detail about the Sixers in our starting lineup. So that's something that you have to understand when you get into it. I didn't really understand it. And then, you know, you take on a real obligation to help the communities where you're playing. So, I mean, but it's been a fun run, and we continue to be together in sports and look at things in sports.
Yeah. So to tell us a little bit about Harris Blitzer and that platform you've created now with the ownership of the teams. I know you guys are also doing investments in other areas in sports. What are some of those?
Yeah, so sports is an incredible draw of everyone's interest, right? So the amount of technology and innovation that exists in and around sports teams is way greater than the than you would expect relative to the financial size of sports. And so starting with, you know, how you select players, right? We are blessed and lucky to have great front offices, you know, here in Philly, obviously, where I'm sitting, you know, Daryl Morey, who's in essence kind of the father of analytics and basketball. He's now our president GM. We have a huge effort at the Devils led by Tom Fitzgerald, and we use a lot of analytics there. And out of that sort of innovative approach, we've started an innovation lab here on this campus. We have a venture investing arm. And part of what we're trying to do is be on the cutting edge. And then for fan experience, right? And for media, there's the media, these teams and the clubs in the five major sports, baseball, basketball, football, hockey, and soccer, or football, as they call it everywhere else.
Exactly.
In the United States. If you call football soccer in England, they nearly beat you. So like you can't, you gotta be careful with that. But these are global businesses. They're global media interests. Like everyone in the world, now that media content is available everywhere, you can watch the Sixers in China. In fact, a few years ago, there were more people watching the Sixers there than here in Philly. But in the Premier League, people want to watch the best players in the world. So we're lucky enough to own three sports where we are in the leagues with the best players in the world. And so there's a lot of innovation around digitization of media content and how to interact with audiences around the world. And it's evolving towards two-way interaction and betting and analytics, and there's all kinds of innovation going on. And then there's also innovation around fitness and products that can wellness and physical therapy and healing and medical. And so there's innovation everywhere around the sports landscape. And it's interesting, like we can get, you know, oftentimes we'll be able to get engineers or data scientists who could work at Google or the best tech companies in the world because they love sports, and they'll work for much less money than they would in the Silicon Valley. And so like there is this, like you get the best people just like you do on the court or on the ice or on the pitch. And so we've been building around innovation and technology. We also own the Prudential Center, which is today the sixth or seventh most visited arena in the country. Madison Square Garden and Barclays get all the press, but you know what? If you're a huge act, you're going to play in New York, you're going to play in Newark also, and on your way to Philly. So, And then we're doing a lot of other interesting things in and around the sports business.
I want to talk to you just a little bit about, obviously, this past year has been, I mean, with COVID and, you know, a lot of the social justice initiatives. And I know personally, you have been involved in the team and really trying to make change after the George Floyd murder. And if you could speak a little bit about that, how that affected you and maybe some of the things that you've done, you know, now in the community because of it.
Yeah, so my family's always been involved in helping, using sports, the power of sports to help kids and communities that are less privileged. And sports is a hook. So there's nothing like every kid who's good at basketball, right? They want to play in the Sixers arena. They want to meet the players. What you can do is kind of sneak them in through basketball and then give them the lettuce, you know, make them study, keep them safe, give them life skills. And so we're always doing that, whether it be through police athletic league or after school all-stars or with the schools themselves in the communities. But when COVID happened, we really had to pivot and lead. And so we got busy quickly. There were people that were dying. There were people that didn't have food. There were people that didn't have medical equipment. There were frontline workers. And so we literally went quickly. And I think we invested or gave away 10,000 laptops and hundreds of thousands of meals and frontline medical equipment and did medical research for frontline workers. And you know, we did this in Philadelphia, Newark, and Camden, around these areas where these are cities that are deeply in need. And then in March, the end of March, I'll never forget, it was a Saturday night, and I was deeply personally impacted by the George Floyd situation. I was, like all of us, locked up at home trying to protect my family and make sure everyone was okay. And I got a call, like there's been a murder of a Black man in a really terrible way. And we're going to put out a statement. And Elton Brand, this was the business side of the Sixers. And so I quickly got on line and looked at the video, and I was terribly upset by it. And then I called Elton Brand, who was the general manager at that time. And Elton said, I'm only putting out a statement if we do something. And I said, of course we're going to do something. And he said, because this happens all the time. And he related, and I was surprised by that. I was just uneducated. And he related to me just a bunch of personal stories about how he, in even in his own neighborhood, had been, you know, as Elton Brand, had been afraid to come out of his house on one or two occasions. And I was really surprised by that. But I started talking to our players and to people around me. And I realized that this is like just a terrible problem in our country and something that we needed to fix. And so I've gotten deeply involved in, you know, racial justice and creating, you know, an economic environment where Black men and Black women can have the same opportunities that I had or my kids had. It's just not fair. And also where they trying to make it so that they feel safe, you know, just walking on, you know, outside, and they don't feel that they're under threat. And so we've announced in total $20 million of programs. What we're doing here in Philly is doing everything from buying from Black businesses to charitably helping Black neighborhoods, to investing in Black communities, to providing digital assets to Black businesses. And so to sourcing, and it's a whole broad effort to try to change our organization to be much more of a Black-led move. It starts with everything from who we hire to who we promote to helping the HBCUs who don't really have. I'm also helping HBCUs with through Apollo, and the NBA is involved with set up a foundation, and over the next kind of decade is going to invest $150 million into Black communities and helping Black men and women kind of get prepared for better jobs, better lives, better economic opportunities, receive the training education they need to move the ball forward.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's incredible and great what you guys are doing, because some of these things and the things you've talked about, that's going to bring real change, as opposed to things like in the past where I think it's been much more of a here's a quick fix type thing and doesn't work. But when you're talking about investing in these communities, investing in businesses, I mean, that really, at the end of the day, is what really brings true opportunity. So it's really nice to see. I do want to ask, and we don't have too much time left, but if you did have some advice for someone just starting out in their career, there's a lot of people who listen to this show who aren't yet entrepreneurs, who are working in jobs, but they're thinking about taking that leap. What advice would you give someone today about going out and starting their own business?
So I would say do something you're passionate about. You're going to spend an awful lot of time. It'll be a lot of ups, a lot of downs. Know that going in, and be committed, be prepared, do something that you're passionate about. Do it with people you like and that you share the same values with. Over the long run, what is your basic approach to life? What are your values? And who do you want to be around? You're going to be with those people a lot. like everything else, it comes down to being with great people. Make sure, and then I would say, treat your life like an investment. Do what I did when I started a pile. Look at the upsides, look at the downsides. What's your competitive advantage? What are you suited to making an impact on? What do you like to do? If it doesn't work, what are you going to fall back on? How are you financed? Really look at it analytically. A lot of people make emotional decisions and then you live with those decisions. And so those would be my pieces of advice.
Yeah. Well, we'll end there. I'll have to say the sounds like the best investment you ever made was in yourself and doing that, you know, starting back from that determination, dedication you learned through wrestling and keeping that going and following through. And I know you're still super competitive. So I'm sure you're living and dying these next few weeks with the Sixers here in the playoffs.
This is the moment. We're well set up. The players are locked in and we're very, very hopeful that we can deliver for the city.
Well, best of luck, man. I love how you said it, for the city, right? It's the jersey for the city. And like you said, it's bigger than any of us.
Absolutely.
Especially in Philly, man. They got fans there. They'll tell you what they think.
They're not shy. No. Let's put it that way. I've been through good and bad. They're not shy.
I love it. All right, Josh, thanks so much for joining us. That was great.
Thanks for having me.
And that's our episode. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to How Success Happens wherever you get your podcasts. We come out with a new episode every Wednesday morning, and you don't want to miss it. And if you like to share, please feel free to pass along the show to an entrepreneur friend who could use a boost, and I could always use the subscribers. And do you have ideas for guests? I always love to hear about great entrepreneurs. If you know anyone, shoot me an email at hsh@entrepreneur.com. or on Twitter at Robert Tuchman, that's RobertTuchman, or even send me a message on LinkedIn. How Success Happens is a production of Entrepreneur Media. Be sure to visit entrepreneur.com for insight on building your business, or even better yet, subscribe to our magazine. No joke, I found my first job after reading about a company in Entrepreneur Magazine back in the 1990s. It's always been my absolute favorite magazine for entrepreneurs. Thanks for listening and spending some time with me today. Until next time, my name is Robert Tuchman, just a fellow entrepreneur and your host. See you soon.